Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay. So, we're up to Perek Lamed Hey of the Netach Yisrael. And he's going to focus here in this Perek on an Agadata in Sanhedrin about the end of days. No big surprise there. And specifically, the major topic that we're going to be talking about is Sukkas David HaNefoles, where we refer to David HaMelech's kingdom as the falling Sukkah of David, his monarchy, his aristocracy, whatever you would have it as Sukkas David HaNefoles, and he's going to discuss, well, again, that's going to be the major focus, but there's going to be other things really around, in and around that that Gemara that he's going to discuss as well. The Gemara says on the very bottom of Daf Tzadi Vav Amud Beis in Sanhedrin, Omar le Rav Nachman le Yitzchak, mi shmi alach emas osi bar nafli. Have you heard when the bar nafli is going to come? Bar nafli means the son of the nafli, of the fallers, of the ones who fall. Right? So have you heard when it's going to come? Omar le man bar nafli. Who are you referring to when you speak about the bar nafli? Says the Gemara, Amar le Mashiach. I mean the Mashiach. Mashiach, Bar Nafli, Koresle, why are you calling him, the children of those who fall? Amar le in. Dichsiv bayemahu okim esukas David hanefoles. The verse says in Amos that on that day I will make upright the Sukkah of David that is falling. So therefore we can refer to it indeed in our time. We can refer to it as the Bar Nafle, as the one of the fallers. So he said to him, Amar le hachi amar Rav Yechanan. This is what Rav Yechanan said. And he goes on to bring a lengthy, litany of things that are characteristic of the time when the Mashiach will come. He says, Darshim and David Babai, the generation when David comes, Talmidei Chachamim Mismatim. There's going to be a reduction in the amount of Torah scholars. Vashor and everybody else, Einayim Kolos B'yogin V'anocha, their eyes are Kolos. Kolos means, is a term for, that means their eyes are finished. It's also a term which is used for yearning. Their eyes yearn, right? They're waiting. Rabbi Rashi explains this term in Chumash, because the Pasuk, Einayim Kolos Aleihem Kolayim, the Pasuk says, the idea is that you're waiting. It means you're looking. When's it going to be already? And like your eyes get worn out from the person's eyes get worn out from the long wait for fulfillment. With yoga and va'anocha, with agony and sighs. But tzareis rabbis, and many difficulties. Ukzeres kashais, and difficult decrees. Mischachais are renewed. Achari shein epkuda shnia memeheres lovei. When the first one is done, right? Before they have a breather, the second one is already upon them. So that's the description of those times. Right? Again, just in terms of some of the little things which he speaks about here, so to speak, the Maharal. So he says there are different aspects to tzara, to difficulty. Sometimes it's that it just keeps going and going and going. It's so long, like waiting for relief, whatever the difficulty is. If a person just has like a minor nagging headache, but it just stays with them. It's not a minor thing anymore. So that's the characteristic of kolos. They're waiting for it to end. It just keeps going and going and going. And then tzoreis rabbis. There's another difficulty which comes when it's all kinds of things. This is happening, and that's happening, and the other thing's happening. And even if each one by itself is not so terrible, but the cumulative effect can be overwhelming. And then the third thing is gzeres kashos, decrees which are themselves very, very, very difficult. So he speaks about this, and he goes on as the Gemara speaks about other things which happen in those times. Really, he skips ahead to other things which happen in those times, and he has different cheshbonos, different aspects. But I want to spend our main time, our main focus here, on his description of Sukkas David Hanayfalas, on Maral's understanding of this piece in the Gemara of Sukkas David Hanayfalas. The premise of everything that we really talk about here, of course, is that what we said before, Maral already alluded to this before in some discussion of Nefila. You know, the idea that Moshiach comes with a clean slate, right? It's Havaya Chadasha. It's like a new world order. And when you need a new world order, you need the old one to sort of like break down first. The old one to break down first. La'alein Rachmano Litzlan. But you need things to break down before you can sort of like start fresh to be the true candidate of change. So whenever we speak over here to some degree about Nefalas, about that which falls and has to be uprighted, so that's part of the idea here, that there has to be, unfortunately, there has to be something of a collapse in order to allow the new to arise. But what's this idea referring to David HaMelech's kingdom as Sukkas David HaNefalas? And the Maral starts by pointing out something which is very, very important and very, very interesting. In Parsha Shmos, we have the story of the Jewish people with the decree upon them from Paro that all the children at childbirth should be killed. And there were two Jewish midwives, Shifra and Pua, who we identify with the mother and sister of Moshe Rabbeinu, Yocheved and Miriam, and they, with ingenuity, avoided carrying out this horrible, horrible decree of Paro Melech Mitzrayim. And the Pasuk says, Vayi ki yaru hamialdes asoel lakim, it was when these midwives demonstrated this fear of God, so it says, Hashem made for them batim. He made for them houses. What does it mean, he made for them houses? That was a reward, that he made for them houses. So it doesn't literally mean that he made for them houses, right? That was not the issue. The house that's referred to here is what we call a dynasty. Right? A bias is like a firm standing house family. A dynasty, that's what Batim means. And what does it mean? It means that he made from them Bate Kuhuna, Bate Levia, and Bate Malchus. The dynasties which exist in Jewish life. In Jewish life, we say there are three crowns, there are three areas of prominence. Two of them are dynasties, one of them is not. Right? The Keser of Kahuna, the crown of Kahuna, of priesthood, that's a dynasty. It's given to Aaron, right, and to his sons. Right? So it ultimately, of course, came from Yocheved. Right? The Bate Levia, right? Levia, that today would be Leviam, right? That came also from Yocheved. That's all part of the same sort of type of dynasty. And then there's Batei Malchus. There's the dynasty of royalty. There's the Keser Malchus, the crown of kingdom, and that also is a dynasty. And that went to Yehuda and to his descendants, specifically through Peretz, through David HaMelech. Those descendants also, they have this dynasty of being the kings, and that came from Miriam, right? Because Miriam married into the family of Yehuda, married Kolev, right? So that's where that was to be found. So we have this idea that the Hashem rewarded them for whatever reason. Hashem rewarded them because of their Yirah Shamayim, because of their fear of heaven, which we're Me'at Hashem, we're going to get back to. Hashem rewarded them with these batim, with these things that are described as houses. Because again, it's like a familial dynasty. It's something which lasts forever. Now, here we refer to it not as a house, but as, fascinatingly, the contrast to a house, which is a sukkah. A sukkah is, you go out of your house, you go out of the bayis, and you go into the sukkah, into the temporary house, into the temporary dwelling. How do you put these two things together? Right? On the one hand, you have the pasuk that specifically refers to kingdom as a house, to the monarchy as a house, and here we refer to it as the sukkah of David. So if somebody asked me this question by myself, I would say that the answer is because since the pasuk is in itself referring to the lapse in the kingdom, that's why you refer to it as a sukkah, because we're talking about the frailty of the kingdom. It fell. It collapsed. So rather than referring to it as a house that collapsed, right, you refer to it by what it seems to be exhibiting currently, which is its frail nature. That's why in this context specifically, it's referring to it as Sukkas David HaNefolos. However, the Maharal doesn't go with that, and I think there are obvious reasons why one would not want to go with that, because it is a house that collapsed that has to be reestablished to some degree as a house. It doesn't make it, the fact that it collapsed right now doesn't mean that all the time it was the Sukkah of David rather than the house of David. One could say it, one could argue it, but that's not the way the Maharal understands it. And he says, no, Abayis is something which speaks of something which is firm and strong within this world, but Malchus Beis David is called a Sukkah. And why is it called a Sukkah? He says a regular Malchus, a regular kingdom, a secular kingdom can be called a Abayis, but the Malchus of David HaMelech was called a Sukkah. Why is it called a Sukkah? So he's of course going to make the comparison to Sukkah as Diras Arai. But the fundamental notion which he teaches over here, we're going to try to approach in a couple of steps. You know, there's a pasuk which we say every Tuesday as the psalm of the day, the song of the day, the Shir Shel Yoy Mizmor LeAsaf, Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Keil. God stands in the Adas, in the assembly of Keil. What does that mean? Bekerav Elohim Yishpot. Hashem is there. The Gemara understands that what this refers to is that when you have judges that get together to try to give Din Torah, to give the Torah law, so Hashem is there with them. Hashem is over their shoulder. Elokim Nitzav Ba'adaskel. V'imchem L'dvar HaMishpot. There's a certain divine presence because they're there trying to bring down the divine law, to apply the divine law. So there's a divine presence that's there with them. But the Gemara says a very interesting thing. It says, Elokim Nitzav. Hashem is standing there. The judges, what is their position? They're supposed to be seated. So you have this ironic thing that these judges who are there in order to effectuate, to promulgate the law of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they're sitting, and Hashem, whose law it is standing. What's going on? Elokim Nitzav Ba'adas Keil. So the Gemara speaks about it a little bit, and the Maharal explains it like this in a very, very simple, beautiful way. He says that yeshiva, to sit, is to be settled. It's to be settled. The dayanim, the judges, in fact, their very job, their very task, is to some degree to be settled in this world. Right? They have to understand the realities of this world in order to be able to do it. You know, the Gra, the Goyen of Vilna, in his Perush on Mishlei, I think it's in the fourth paragraph, the sixth paragraph, the pasuk says, you know, you don't let your eyes sleep. Al titein shena la'apecha la'einecha utnum la'apecha. Don't let your eyes sleep nor your eyelids slumber. Right, this is one of the great challenges of how you learn Mishlei, Proverbs. The verses constantly seem to repeat themselves in different words. And you have to understand, it's not repeating itself, there's a nuance to each one. So the Gra, in his commentary on Mishlei, who does this kind of thing all the time, you know, explores these kinds of distinctions all the time, he says like this, if I went like this right now, so would my eyes be asleep? My eyes wouldn't be asleep, my eyes are awake, I'm alert, I'm thinking. It's just that my shades are down, right? My eyelids are down. Right, there's such a thing as your eyes being asleep, which is like when you're completely asleep. So then, like, you know, you turn them off, right? And then there's when your eyelids are down, when you're fundamentally awake and your eyes are awake, but just that your eyelids are closed. So he says there's two kinds of being, of being. He says there's the ivory tower, right? There's Torah scholarship, so to speak, of the ivory tower, where a person secludes themselves in a world of Hashem's wisdom and tries to identify with and understand Hashem's wisdom. In a certain sense, they're connecting so completely to the world of truth, to the world of the abstraction. It's almost like They're going into a theoretical world. They're going up into, you know, into the heavenly sphere of understanding Hashem's true wisdom. He says that's, if a person would shut that off, that would be closing down their eyes. That would be their eyes going to sleep. But he says there's another level, which is that the person's not in the ivory tower. It's not another, it's another function where the person is a, the way he refers to it is as a dayan, as a judge. His example is a judge. Where a dayan can't just know the ivory tower theoretics. He also has to understand the practical realities that are in front of him in order to apply the theoretics to the practicalities. Right? You can learn theory, but if you, you know, of the halacha, but if you don't understand sometimes how the market works, you won't be able to necessarily plug in correctly to apply the halacha. So he says, for that, those who are functioning in that role, not only do their eyes have to be awake, but their eyelids also have to be up so that they can interact with the world. A dayan very, very much has to be settled down here in this world. He's bringing the divine truths into this world, but he has to be settled into this world of reality, in order to be able to apply the Torah to reality. But Hashem doesn't sit. It's not a matter of disrespect that we're sitting while Hashem is standing. It's the opposite. Hashem is to some degree transcending this world. His relationship with this world is a little bit floaty, a little bit fleeting. He's not settled down in here, right? Hashem, he's here. He's here. He's a presence, right? But not quite, you know, completely, so that we, so to speak, settled a part of it. The judge who's able to be a part of it, he has the job of applying those things. So that's a first perspective, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as he is in this world, is not going to be so completely fixed within this world. Now, David, Moshiach, we've spoken of him as being that ultimate picture of completion. And one of the things, you know, some of the things we didn't, you know, go into completely, but Moshiach is necessarily such another worldly quality that it's not really a part of this world. That's why you need to knock it down, knock down the world and start again to remake the world in a way which is suitable for it. So he says the Malchus of David HaMelech is a divine Malchus. It's the Malchus which is supposed to be the Malchus of Moshiach. The Malchus that heralds the coming of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where Hashem's presence is explicit and clear. And because of that, it can't be settled in this world. Until, of course, its ultimate time, when the world becomes filled with the knowledge of Hashem. So meanwhile, we refer to it as Sukkas David. Because the Sukkah is not a fixed, established house. The Sukkah is a temporary dwelling, being that the Malchus of David HaMelech is supposed to be so reflective of the divine, just like Hashem doesn't, so to speak, sit down in this world, he just stands here offering something of a presence. The house of David is also not quite so firmly established here. That's an angle of the way the Maharal explains this idea. And I'll read to you the words which he says. He says, Malchus Beis David, Malchus Beis David Sukkah. If you show Malchus Beis David, Malchus Eloki, the kingdom of David HaMelech is supposed to be like a divine kingdom. It's supposed to be the human expression of the divine kingdom, like a Meishar Malchus Shulcha, not like other kingdoms that are secular. That's why we don't call it a house which is a fixed building, like natural things which are fixed in the world. But the spiritual things, the godly things, in this world as it is, they are not fixed. They are temporal, temporary. Like a sukkah, which is temporary. And that's why by the sukkah, Maral follows through, and he says, why when we have the mitzvah of sukkah, literally, that's when we say this verse, that's why everybody knows this expression, sukkas David HaMelech. Not because we're all so familiar with the verses in the Navi Amos, right? But because in benching on Sukkos, we end and we say, "Harachman hu yakim lanu es Sukkas David anayfalas." Hashem, you should, you know, reestablish for us the Sukkah of David, which has fallen. It should set it right, right? So that's the reference to the Sukkah. So the sukkah is also this way? So he says, yeah. Because the sukkah is a mitzvah elikis, it's a godly mitzvah, therefore the building which represents it is appropriate to be arai v'loy keva. It's to be temporal and not permanent. And you know, he's very, very limited over here in this description of it, but you know, Rabbi Hartman brings, you know, what the Maral writes in other places, things which we know about the nature of the sukkah. That the sukkah is there to remind us of the time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu had us travel through the Midbar. I'm not saying exactly what he says, but you know, pretty much, you know, the idea is a familiar one, and one which he, you know, he quotes him from the Chidush HaGadol of Avodah Zarah, where the Gemara speaks about the Yom Tov of Sukkos a little bit, and the nations of the world keeping the Yom Tov of Sukkos. But the idea is Sukkos is to remind us of how we lived in the desert, right? How Hashem took care of us when we lived there in the desert. So what's the idea of Diras Arai? Because the desert is not a normal place, right? Hashem made of the world, he made one, the Gemara says he made it three parts. One part is seas, one part is inhabitable land, and one part is wilderness, right? And the wilderness is not a place which is meant to be settled. And therefore, to some degree, when Hashem gave us the Torah, he gave it to us there. Because the Torah is this spiritual, godly peace, and reconciling it, making it a part of the world, that's part of the challenge. Does it necessarily have such a fixed place within the world? So that period where we were there in the desert, the period which we refer to as Eichle Haman, where we didn't eat earthly food, but we ate heavenly food, we ate the man which came from the heavens, right, was an experience for human beings down on this earth of pure, you know, 100% spirituality. And that expresses itself when we remember it in our lives. We remember it as a diras arai, as a temporary dwelling, because it's fleeting. Just like Hashem's presence in this world is not going to be so fixed, you know, reconciling it with the physical fixed, you know, strong stuff. That's the way it was in the desert. Everything we had was completely dependent on Hashem. Our existence there was, you know, sort of, it was fleeting. It was one day at a time. It was the complete presence of the Spirit, and it didn't lock in so much to the normal fixed property of the physical world. The more divine something is, the more detached it is, to a certain degree, from the permanence and the fixed nature of this world. So that's our Sukkah of Sukkos, and that's Sukkas David, that's the Malchus of David HaMelech, yes.
Is it locked in after Mashiach comes?
So after Mashiach, when we talk about the ultimate end of days, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence on this world is the norm, so then, you know, then things can change. Then that becomes the permanent state of being of the earth itself. But as long as we're functioning in this model, so Ha'oretz Nasan Livnei Adam, you know, the earth is given to man and man is doing his thing here, so it's a different story. It's a different story at this point. Baruch Ato Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyah B'dvarei. Now, saying that the kingdom of David HaMelech is a divine kingdom, you know, can sound very, very mystical. Very mystical. You know, you know, not as mystical as some other things, right? Because after all, we understand that David is supposed to be the king who presides over the Moshiach, which is where Hashem, V'hoya Hashem l'melech al kol aretz, Hashem will be king over the whole world. So he's supposed to be as transparent a king as possible in that sense. He's associated with Malchus Shamayim, with the kingdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But let's also understand it in a way which is not so mystical, and in a way which also translates into our understanding of things when it comes to Sukkah, and which is very, very practical in terms of the fixed and the temporal. You know, the king had a bunch of mitzvahs. In fact, there's one mitzvah, which is a mitzvah for everybody, that the Torah chooses to specifically tell us when it comes to the king. What's that? Okay, so we have here a couple. So we have Hakel. Hakel is a mitzvah for the king to read the Torah to everybody else. And to some degree, that is to reflect the idea that we have over here. even version one, which is you're putting the king in a special role. He's the one who's supposed to share the Torah with the whole people. This is a reenactment of Har Sinai. Har Sinai, right? You get everybody together, men, women, children, doesn't matter how old, right? Like at Har Sinai. Har Sinai, who spoke to the people? Hashem. You know, here it's the Melech, it's the king. But that's the idea, right? When those of you who I don't know if any of you were, but some of you might have been with us on the first nights of Sukkot between Mincha and Ma'ariv, we were learning about the mitzvah of Hakel, and this was one of the nights. This was the notion which we put forward, that it's part of Hakel is not just to reenact Har Sinai; it's to define what a king of the Jewish people is. One of the parshios that you read on Hakel. Right, you read on Hakel, the parts of the Torah which I read are like these big global parshios, you know, Shema and Hayim Shamoah and Aseres Hadibros, you know, like all the other brachos, the klolos. And you know what else you read? You read the parsha of appointing a king. Like, one of these things is not like the other. One of these things just doesn't belong. Right? So, you know, like, what's going on over here? Why are you reading the parsha of the king? The reason is because the parsha of the king is that we're trying to understand that this whole maima, this whole position is to some degree to tell you what the relationship is between the king and the Jewish people. The king is the one who's supposed to be conveying. He carries with him a Sefer Torah all of the days of his life. He's supposed to be there to channel divine kingdom to the Bnei Yisrael. He's the one to communicate Torah. So we're telling him, you do not occupy a purely secular office. You're here to bring the Torah down to the people. We're telling ourselves that's our yachas, that's our connection to the king. So, okay, Hakel is a mitzvah that everybody has to be there, and the king has to do himself. Writing a Sefer Torah, right? Everybody has a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah, and the Torah tells everybody that they have a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah. By the king, it tells them an extra mitzvah. Maybe the king has to write a second Sefer Torah. Maybe the king has to have one with him all of the days of his life. There's some special rules that apply to the king in that regard. But there's one mitzvah which it says, according to some, it's considered an actual mitzvah, mitzvah loisaseh. And it says it only by the king, even though it applies equally to everybody else. What does it say by the king? So let me read you quickly the parsha. When you come to the land that Hashem gives you, you'll say, let me make a king like other nations. So put on yourself a king that Hashem chooses. You can't put on yourself an ishnachri, an outsider. He has to be one of yours, just. He shouldn't have horses, a lot of horses, right? So he shouldn't bring the people back to Mitzrayim, so they'll have a lot of horses. So it says you're not supposed to go back there. He shouldn't have a lot of wives, right? Because his heart will stray. He shouldn't have kesef ezav. He shouldn't have tons of silver and gold. V'hoya k'shiftei, and he says he sits on the throne of kisei mamlachtei, then he should write the Torah, etc. And he should read it all the day of his life in order that he should learn. L'man yilmad. L'yiroes Hashem alekov. To fear Hashem as God. L'shmores kodiri ha-Torah azos ha-sachukim eil ha-saisim. To observe all these laws, to perform them. Levilti rum levavei me'achav, so that his heart should not be lifted up over his brothers. Levilti surmin ha-mitzvah yamin usmael, so he should not deviate from the mitzvah right and left. So he should have long life on the throne, he and his children, v'kerev Yisrael. So what does it say? He has to make sure to stick to the mitzvah. Okay, that's easy. He has to make sure not to become haughty, not to become arrogant. Right? This is the mitzvah, the prohibition of gaiva. Levilti rum levavei me'achav, right, is said over here by the melech, said by the king. Now, of course, you understand, the king would have the easiest temptation to become higher and more arrogant than everybody else. He is actually, in his position, higher and above everybody else. However, it's a mitzvah which applies to everybody. Levilti rum levavei me'achav. So what's the nature, indeed, of this mitzvah? And what's this that we are asking of the king to do when we do this? So what's very critical is that the king has to be cognizant of Malchus Shammai. You remember when the Jewish people first asked for a king in the days of Shmuel, so there was a feeling that Shmuel had, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said was the fact, was that this was a rejection of Hashem to a certain degree. They were choosing a king, a human being who would be upon them. And, of course, again, like all powerful positions, it carries with it this temptation, mm-hmm. that the person can forget that there's anything above them. They view themselves as the ceiling. They view themselves as the top of the pyramid. And there's a special, special need to make sure that the Melech is always aware of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that, you know, many of the things which we prohibit him from doing, okay, you'll say, do we worry about this, that, there's a bottom line concern about power. Right? He's not supposed to have a lot of silver and gold. What does that mean? Right? The Rishonim understand, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says, that means he's not supposed to tax. He says, you know, you find Shlomo HaMelech had a lot of horses. Right? He failed in that one. He had a lot of wives. He failed in that one. What about the other one? Was that he taxed the Jewish people heavily. We know that. That was Levilti, V'chesev Zov Le'arbelei Moed, meaning, you know, if he makes a lot of money, great. But if he taxes... Okay, thank you. The general position of power, but he has to remember, it's very, very important that he remember Liyira es Hashem. Like the Pasuk says, Ekev Anava Yiras Hashem. Like the heel or the result of humility or together with humility is the fear of Hashem. Anava and Yiras Hashem, humility, the opposite of arrogance and fear of God, are very, very important twins. They're very, very important things that have to really, really very much come together. And the bias, the house, the sense of permanence, the sense that, you know, here we have it, we have this dynasty and it's going to last forever, you know, that is clearly, clearly, clearly the easy path to forgetting responsibility towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to forgetting the ultimate deference. So even as David was established as the permanent king, so to speak, the permanent household where the kingdom would reside, but he was not told that it was going to be permanent and consistent, uninterrupted. It would be interrupted. When his children, who would sit on the throne, would start to forget Hashem, would start to be intoxicated by some degree of the arrogance and thinking they're the king and the buck stops there, that's it, then the kingdom is lost. The kingdom is lost. So there's Sukkas David. It's not a comment here on the frailty of it because you've got to watch out, you're going to be in trouble. But in a great sense, that's the nature of a sukkah. That's what we try to do with the sukkah. Right? We live in a house regularly, and we very, very much, it's a house, we built it, and it's our source of preservation. What's the Yom Tov of Sukkos about? The Yom Tov of Sukkos is about the Yom Tov of recognizing that your fate is in the hands of Hashem. Right? In the desert, when we lived, we had no illusions. We had absolutely no illusions. Our four walls were constructed by Hashem. Our food, right, was not, we had no bank account. We had nothing to bank on, right? We went to sleep at night with nothing, and the Gemara says every night they daven marav like it was Yom Kippur, because they had nothing. They had mouths full to feed and they had nothing. They were in the middle of the desert. The next morning they would get their portion for the day. The sense of dependence on Hashem was absolute. And we come to Sukkot right after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is where we build in ourselves that absolute sense of dependence. Our entire faith is in the hand of Hashem. And Sukkot, we go from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, where that is, oh my gosh, our presence, you know, everything is in the hands of Hashem, it's the time of judgment, to Sukkot, which is where we say, oh, joy, 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 Zman Simchaseinu, that everything that we have in the, is subject to the hands of Hashem. And the more we build something up and the more we make it strong, the less Hashem figures in it. The less it's His. The less it's subject to His control. Right? The more, again, you know, as we say, you know, you go into your house, right, today, and what's it going to be? It's going to be 71 degrees, right? You went into your house in August, and what's it going to be? It's going to be 71 degrees. Or you go outside, or you go into the sukkah, or you go outside, and, well, I don't know, what does the world have in store for me today? But when I get into my house, there, I control. This is climate control. This is life control. This is, I'm going to be able to be master of my own fate. So to some degree, the Malchus of David is going to be effective to the extent that it is a sukkah. To the extent that it understands who really, ultimately, is king. Who ultimately controls this whole thing. You understand why David HaMelech was not just a great king, And David HaMelech was not just a great warrior, but David HaMelech was the one who wrote our Tehillim. Because that's the way a king would be king. Tehillim are the songs of Emunah, the songs of recognition. If there is a repeated theme in Tehillim, it's that, okay, everything goes on in the world around us, but we trust that Hashem makes everything go. Everything goes on around me, right? Everything is happening, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects me in His sukkah. Hashem, right? Everything, all the connotations. That was David HaMelech. David HaMelech didn't have to bring just the glory of the Beis HaMikdash to the people. Right? We think about David Melech HaMashiach, right? And everything else. But what's David's impact in our day-to-day lives? Today. What's his impact on our day to day lives? His impact on our day to day lives is that he wrote the Psukei de Zimra that we said at the beginning of davening, all those psalms, right, about the which teach us to train in and realize the great power of Hashem. It's our Shevach, Kedem L'Bakasha, according to many Rishonim. It's our praise before we make our request to recognize the great power of Hashem and our complete dependence on Him. That's what we have from David HaMelech. Faith. The language of faith, the expressions of faith, that's what we have from David HaMelech. Sukkas David. That's the idea of the Sukkah of David. So, yeah, my Folas, it falls. The kingdom falls. We have to start again when the kingdom has some failing. The world has to be remade. But it's Sukkas David. Carries with it always that notion to some degree of that which is temporary. I'll just tell you something quickly before we try to do this. But you know, you find this notion that it says, you know, when the Yovel comes, when the Jubilee year comes, so then every field that a person had in Eretz Yisrael that he sold comes back to him. Why? Because, look, you know, it's not really yours. The land really isn't yours. It's mine, right? You sold it? Fine. So you gave up your, so to speak, your lease on it for the next thing, but then I'm giving it back to you. It's mine. You can't really sell it. There's an exception to the rule of what property you can't sell. You know what that is? Exactly, a walled city, a house, a base, Meishav Yerchema, a house that you have in a walled city. What's the difference? Because a walled city, you're not putting yourself in the hands of Hashem. A walled city, you build up your own fortifications, you build up your own defenses. And when you do that, so then, right, the bad news is you sell the house, it ain't coming back to you because it's yours. Because we made it ours. Because when we create our own fortifications, our own protections, I'm not telling you practically speaking, this is what you should do or this is what you shouldn't do, right? In our world, you know, the relationship between our efforts and the trust that we put in Hashem, you know, is a complicated thing, right? But the fact of the matter is that to some degree, you've taken over. You said, Hashem, I'm going to take care of myself here. I'm protecting myself, and to some degree, that's appropriating that land from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The more fixed it is, the more established it is, the more protection there is that we have erected of our own human beings around it, the less that we have that connection, the less of a sukkah it is, the less of a connection it is to Hashem. So there's many things to explore here, but I just want, you know, with regard to this. But listen, yeah, I'm sorry.
Didn't David Melech build a huge palace, you know, and a whole... significant structure, you know, for him to live in?
Absolutely. And he said that this is completely incongruous, that I should live in a palace while Hashem is still in a tent. That was what David HaMelech, that was part and parcel of his sensitivity. Hine anoichi yoshev v'veis arozim v'aroin ha'alekim b'seich ha'yiriyah. I'm sitting in a cedar building and Hashem's ark is sitting under a tent roof. What's the idea? Hashem living in a tent, like the Mishkan, means impermanence. You know, Hashem's not really settled in this world. Elokim nitzav badaskil. God isn't really settled down here on this world. How could I be settled on this world without Hashem being settled on this world? And that was where David HaMelech began the process of the building of a magnificent and majestic Beis HaMikdash, where Hashem would be settled into this world, where that would be the way that it would be. And that's exactly, to a great degree, what motivates David HaMelech. I just want to point you to one thing. Beis Yisrael Baruchu Es Hashem. The Bais, the house of Israel, should bless Hashem. Beis Aaron Baruchu Es Hashem. Beis Halevi Baruchu Es Hashem. Yirei Hashem Baruchu Es Hashem. Those who fear Hashem should bless Hashem. You notice? House. Those who fear Hashem should bless Hashem. It's not once. We do it another time. Anybody know where we do it the other time? Excellent. Hallel. This was in the Tilim Kuf Lamed Hey, right, which is Psukat Zimra of Shabbos, right before the Hallel HaGadol, the great Hallel. But in regular Hallel, we say a very, very similar thing. What do we say? Yisrael betach b'Hashem, Ezra Maginahu. Beis Aaron bitchu b'Hashem, Ezra Maginahu. Yirei Hashem bitchu b'Hashem, Ezra Maginahu. Well, we also, there's this thing. And that's the Pasuk in Chumash. What did the Pasuk in Chumash say by the Mialdos? Vahi ki yoru ha-Mialdos es Elokim, when they had fear of Hashem, then Hashem made them batim. Then Hashem made them houses. What does that mean? You know, if you're going to build a house without being God-fearing, so then it's not going to work. It's not going to work. To the extent that you're God-fearing, then you can build a house. Then the house is not going to be in that which creates the illusion. Then the house really, in a certain sense, is a sukkah, you know? But then you can build a house. And it's a way to perceive, try to remember this for next year, it's a way to perceive Shmini Atzeres, or Simchas Torah. Why? Because you see it from one of the Targum Yonasan Ben Uziel, says Shmini Atzeres, isn't it, okay, the mitzvah of sukkah is over. Okay, forget the sukkah now, you go back into the house. The Shmini Atzeres is the celebration of going back into the house. And you could see it as a culmination. That if you've spent Elul and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you know, on the vulnerability to Hashem, and you spent the 7 days of sukkah celebrating out there in the atmosphere, that where everything is in the hand of Hashem, now I can go into the house. Now I have Yiras Hashem. Now I can go into the house, and the house will stand. Because I'll understand that Hashem's there in the house too. So this is, to some degree, this is the relationship which we're praying over here. That's levilti rumo vavay me'achav. That's the humility and the fear of Hashem that's fundamental to the king. It's fundamental to the dynasty. It's fundamental for anything lasting. Okay, now I want to share with you one more thing, one more thing about this notion of the sukkah, and then a couple of little pieces we'll quickly wrap up. Tell me something. You know, where's your sukkah now? Basement, garage. So what, you took the sukkah, right, and you went and you put it in the basement?
Broke it down first.
No, you took the sukkah, you took it apart, right? Mm-hmm. And then you put it in your basement. You say, my sukkah's in my basement, right? So somebody's going to go in there looking, you know, it's my sukkah, okay? Now, lo lein rachmono litzlan. You know, somebody lives in someplace out in the country, their house was completely destroyed by a tornado. Right? Right? So they come there, right? And it's just a bunch of twisted metal, broken down wood, you know, tiles, shingles, you know, like all over the place. Yeah. So the first 2 days, right, they're going to go, okay, that's my house, that's my house, that's my house. Right? But when they get past it, not 2 days, whenever it is that they get past it, and they're going to say, okay, now, here, this is my house. It's not my house. It's the ruins of a house. Right? Your sukkah, right? You take it apart, it falls down, and it's still your sukkah. Because that's the nature of the thing, right? It's not made to be permanent. And therefore, it comes down, and even when it's down, it's still there. However, by the house, when it comes down, it's gone. It's finished, right? Start again, maybe you'll be able to salvage a few raw materials, right? But that's it. So the Maharal says, it's a nice idea. He says that that's part of the idea of referring to David HaMelech's kingdom as Sukkas David HaNefolos. Because David HaMelech's house is sometimes down, but it's never out. It's never out. Whether because of the fact that we know that this is the one that's going to reemerge. Or even more profoundly, the Gemara says, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. The scepter, the rod of the kings will never leave Yehuda. And the Gemara says from this that even when the Jewish people are in Golus, right, but you'll find that the leadership comes from David, comes from Yehuda. Right? Even sometimes, right, they bring even not the formal positions there, it's referring to Rashi, Goliash, Shabbal, Exilarchs, formal leadership positions, but in general, there's some association always. Even when it's down, it's not out. So that's a term of Sukkas David HaNefolos. Very, very meaningful. And to some degree, that also connects very much with the, you know, like the Beis HaMikdash thing. Right? Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Right? Once the Beis HaMikdash is in its place, Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, but that place still has Kedusha. It still has sanctity. Now, once it's really established there, so, okay, it's down, but it's not out. And there's still some presence of the Shechina and the Kosel Maravi always, you know, Chazal say, there's still some presence over there in the west of the complex, by the western wall. Hashem's presence is still there. Down, but not gone. Not completely out. Okay, so that's the Tawish Yisrael. And I just want to mention two more parperos, two more little thoughts, just before we close. If you notice, when we read the Gemara, the first thing it said before in the generation of Mashiach, he asked him, "How do you know when Mashiach is going to come?" So he says, "Talmidei Chachamim Mismatim." The first thing was Torah scholars will be reduced. What Al says, very simple, according to everything we've learned all the time and understand, is because the idea is that if there is a strong presence of Torah and Hashem's wisdom, so then you don't have the collapse. The collapse comes. Everything which is described, this whole collapse of the order of the world, which is described here, is because of the absence of that. The absence of a vivid presence of Hashem. So that's the first step which would happen. Okay? Quick and easy. But I just want to share with you the last thing, one of the last things in this parak. We're not doing everything in it, which is very, very, very nice. He says, the Gemara says at a certain point, right, the destruction is so complete, right, to the point where the whole malchus, the whole kingdom, turns to heresy. And David will come until the whole kingdom gets turned to heresy. Amar Rava Mikra, what is the pasuk that indicates this? So he says, "Kula hafach lavan tarhu," because the pasuk says, if the tsaras, the leprosy, is such that the whole thing turns white, then it's going to be pure. Leprosy is a spot of white, a location. But when the whole thing turns white, then it's going to be tar. Now that's normally considered to be one of the great chukim, one of the great inexplicable things. How could it be that when it's partially white, it's tameh, when it's completely white, it's tar? So the Maharal explains, really, according to his derech, according to his way, that we started off with today and that we've touched upon and Maral has taught us upon many times in the past. And he says like this, because when the Taras is like a little bit of death, you know, it's a partial death of the skin there, of the flesh there, Al Notehi Kames, So he says, it's not normal for a living being to have attached to it something which is gangrenous, you know, something which is lifeless. Life and death in one being don't coexist. That's not normal. That's tameh. That creates the tumah called saras. However, for death to take over, right, it's unfortunate, but it's also this idea of clearing the way for the ultimate opening up, for the ultimate heder, havaya, for the ultimate coming into its own. There's always heder kaidem lahavaya. There's always a loss before regeneration, before something comes into being. So he says, in this case, the hefsa, the loss, can be seen as tohar because, again, it's paving the way. And that's what we say, kulei hafach lavan tohar. Sometimes a total breakdown, it's very, very difficult, it's very devastating. But in other ways, it seems to perhaps be clearing the way to start fresh and to make things work. That's some of what he writes here in this prayer. Okay, it's Hashem. We will continue next time. Yes.
Run up something about them. I'm Shlomo Melech.